Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's new report must sound a death knell for coal and fossil fuels before they destroy our planet. Frontline communities have been demanding this for years. The new report answers important questions about how emissions of greenhouse gases and other pollutants are altering our climate, how plants, soils, and the ocean store and release carbon, how the climate responds to human influence, and what we can expect from an increase in global warming. Now, some of the changes already set in motion, such as continued sea level rise, are irreversible, according to the report. But strong and sustained reductions in carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases would limit further damage. The report's 234 scientists cited over 14,000 scientific papers. Linda Mearns is lead author of the Atlas chapter of the climate report. Linda Mearns is a senior scientist and director of the Weather and Climate Impacts Assessment Science Program at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and she's contributed to these reports since 1995. Hi, Linda. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. I'm very glad to be here. I have a lot of friends in the Bay Area, so this is great.
Oh, great. Well, I hope they're listening. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and author of many books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Hi, Professor Mann. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks. It's great to be with you and also to be here with my good friend and colleague, Linda Mearns.
Well, thank you so much. Well, Linda, I want to start off with you because you're lead author of the Atlas chapter of the climate report. In this report, the warnings are very, very clear and very, very stark. A lot of reporters said what really stands out to them is just how clear the language is. One of the main messages is that the window is getting narrower and narrower, but there is still time to tackle this crisis. What would you say stands out to you the most?
Well, first of all, just let me correct you on one thing. I'm one of the lead authors on the Atlas. There are different lead authors for each region. So I'm the lead author for the North America part. Just credit where credit is due, so to speak. So do you mean about the whole report or about how much time we have left?
First, let's talk about the whole report, and then we'll talk about how much time we have left.
Yeah, so as you've stated, and the quotes from the UN, the language keeps on getting clearer and clearer. The use of the climate changes that have already been determined, that it's unequivocal that we have contributed to climate change, and that we are the main source of the greenhouse gases, of course, and thus we are the main forces that are causing the climate change. And I think the report is starker and it is clearer because, of course, science continues to progress. And, for example, there's greater clarity about when we could possibly actually cross this critical threshold of 1.5 degrees C. And there's actually now a 50% chance that global warming of 1.5 could be reached by 2030. And that's in basically 9 years. And I think those kind of stark messages really make a big difference. Something that I really want to emphasize that is somewhat new in this report is the importance of compound extreme events, that we are going to be subjected to not just extreme heat, not just drought, not just extreme fire weather, but all three of those factors at the same time. And I'm thinking particularly right now of the U.S. West, and I'm in the West, I'm in Boulder, Colorado. And as I sit here, I'm essentially breathing in climate change through the air pollution from the fires further west of me. So the point is, I think this report makes it clearer than any other time, that climate change is now. It's not in the future.
Right.
Other types of combination of events will be changes in tropical cyclones, hurricanes, where they will become generally more intense and produce more precipitation. At the same time that, for example, coastal communities, let's say in Florida and the Gulf Coast, are going to be experiencing relatively high sea level rise. And so that combination of more intense tropical storms and higher sea level rise is really going to create very serious flooding problems all along the U.S. coast, but I think particularly along the Gulf Coast and Florida. I'll stop there.
Professor Mann, what would you add?
Yeah, I would underscore what Linda has said here. And in fact, we have seen these sorts of events. Hurricane Florence, when it made landfall in the Carolinas, there was a huge storm surge because it was a very strong hurricane. Piled up a lot of water. So you get that large storm surge that sort of prevents the estuaries from draining as they're being rained on. And so you get all this inland rainfall because it's warmer. There's more moisture in the atmosphere. The storm holds more of that moisture. It can produce more rainfall. And so you get that inland rainfall combining with that coastal surge to give you what they call compound flooding. And this is one of the things that Linda is alluding to. You get these factors coming together often in catastrophic ways. In California, for example, there's an example of, how things sometimes come together in ways we wouldn't have anticipated until they happen. For example, you get that heat and that drought and those epic wildfires that we've seen out west, and we know that that's connected now to climate change. The report really connects the dots. We wouldn't be seeing that epic heat, that drought, these massive wildfires in the absence of the warming of the planet from human activity. That denudes the vegetation, it strips the ground soil of its integrity, and then in the winter, when those winter storms do come in, remember the atmosphere is warmer, it holds more moisture, so you get more rainfall in those winter storms. Even if they're fewer and farther between and they happen later into the season, they're still going to come, and when they come, you get larger amounts of rainfall in short periods of time. It combines with that degraded soil, and you get the sorts of mudslides that we've seen in California in recent years. So here is what I would drive home about this report. More than any previous Working Group 1 scientific assessment report, it connects the dots. For the first time, the IPCC is saying, yes, we would not be seeing the sorts of catastrophic extreme weather events that we're watching play out now in real time this summer and in recent years if it were not for the warming of the planet caused by the burning of fossil fuels and the increase of carbon pollution in the atmosphere.
Linda, 234 authors from 66 countries contributed to this report, citing over 14,000 scientific papers. Major advances in climate science are giving us a much better understanding of our past and present climate. Can you tell us more about these major advances?
Well, one of the major advances, which may not be exactly what you were heading towards in your question, but I think it's a very important point to make, which is that this time around, the structure of the IPCC itself has changed in very significant ways. And mainly this has to do with a real shift in the conceptual framework. And by that I mean that prior to this report, each report, the climate science, the impacts, mitigation, those are the three main reports, were all pretty stovepiped. They didn't have much to do with each other. This time around, there's really been a sea change, if you will, in the structure of the report, such that Working Group 1 now really recognizes that it really needs to connect more clearly to the impacts. And so you'll see new chapters about climate impact drivers, which are climate variables that really cause the impacts that the Working Group 2 report is going to be discussing in great detail. And this is a tremendous change. I can't tell you, since I've been involved in so many of the reports, I'm just thrilled with this change. And I think it makes the reports much more valuable in that they recognize that it's an integrated problem. And we see this, for example, reporters, they almost never want to just stop with what the climate changes are. They always want to know what are the impacts and what do we do about it. Now, the climate change report, the climate science report, is still fundamentally about the climate side, but it's really doing a much better job of recognizing that what people are really concerned about is what the impacts are going to be. And that's just a really great improvement in the reports.
Professor Mann, you wanted to agree there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, I think part of this is just because of the evolution of the science. It's become more interdisciplinary and more integrated. So, for example, when we ask questions about carbon budgets, how much carbon can we still afford to burn and stay below critical warming levels? Well, that is informed by an understanding of the role of the ocean carbon cycle. And that has now been better integrated into the climate models that are used to make climate projections. In the past, we would treat carbon dioxide as if it was simply a control knob that we turn up and the planet warms. But that's not the way it happens. We put carbon into the atmosphere. Some of it is absorbed by the oceans, by the terrestrial biosphere. And that has a bearing on how much carbon pollution we can produce and still remain below critical thresholds. So now the Working Group 3 report, which looks at, you know, what the issue of mitigation, what can we do to prevent further warming of the planet, that is informed very directly by the sorts of climate model experiments that are being done in Working Group 1, the scientific assessment. And how we decide on what those critical thresholds of warming might be is, of course, informed by the impacts. How bad does it get if we warm the planet more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 Fahrenheit? How much worse does it get if we warm the planet more than 2 degrees Celsius, 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit? These are the sorts of questions that the IPCC is now much better situated to answer because of, as Linda describes, the way that the different working groups are really working together sympathetically, coherently, constructively now.
The report also said that scientists are observing changes in the Earth's climate in every region and across the entire climate system. Many of the changes observed in the climate are unprecedented in thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. Linda, can you elaborate on that?
Yes, I think it's important to recognize, and one of the quotes I use, quoting myself, is that really the climate change has advanced in a way, and it's happening everywhere. This means that essentially there is nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Let's look, for example, an area that I'm very concerned with and do some research on, wildfires. And we see right now reports of wildfires in Siberia, Turkey, Greece, of course, the Western U.S., Canada. It's happening everywhere. And this, once again, the fact that so many extremes are happening and affecting people all over the planet is really part of the most important message. For example, all parts of all land masses are going to experience extreme heat, and that's going to be a problem for everywhere. The fires that I've mentioned, the droughts, there are going to be many areas that are going to be very seriously affected by droughts in the U.S., but also in other places. The Mediterranean area is going to see extreme heat and drought as well. And I just want to mention that one of the nicer new features of the report is this interactive atlas, which is part of the atlas work that I did, in which everyone, reporters, regular people, can actually go into this interactive atlas and explore what's happening with the different scenarios, whether or not we have a high emission scenario or a lower one, what's happening to a lot of these variables. For example, there's even a map showing what areas of the globe will experience higher fire weather. And so I think this is a great product, we hope it is, because it'll really hopefully draw people into the issue and make them feel more like they are actually participating, because they can explore these things on their own. So please do, if you get a chance, go and look at that interactive atlas.
You know, Professor Mann, I know we have to let you go in about 10 minutes. You've been on the show many, many times talking about solutions. And, you know, unfortunately, let's say, 7 years ago, a lot of the cable shows still had for lack of a better word, the liars on, saying that this was all still debatable, which we knew it wasn't back then. I mean, Exxon knew it wasn't 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
40 years ago now. And this report makes it so clear, to the point where UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an end to new coal plants and new fossil fuel exploration and development. I mean, frontline communities started saying keep it in the ground many, many years ago. And now that is becoming kind of a mainstream tagline.
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to now see the sort of mobilization that we really should have seen decades ago. And indeed, as you allude to, there has been an ongoing campaign by fossil fuel interests, conservative media outlets that promote their messaging, and conservative politicians who do their bidding to prevent this necessary transition off of fossil fuels towards renewable energy. And thanks to that ongoing campaign, we are decades late in getting, finally getting some sort of action on this problem. And that has a huge cost. It means that we, when we could have brought those carbon emissions down gently over several decades to avoid warming the planet more than 3 degrees Fahrenheit, now we're in a position where we've got to bring them down by 50% within the next decade to do that. And then all the way down to net zero carbon emissions by the middle of the century. That requires dramatic mobilization. It requires immediate cessation. A stop to new fossil fuel infrastructure, as you allude to. The Secretary General has said that. Even the IEA, the Conservative International Energy Agency, that for a long time has really downplayed the importance of the renewable energy transition, has come out and said, yes, it's still possible for us to limit warming below catastrophic levels, but we have to no longer build any new fossil fuel infrastructure. That's the IEA. And we've seen the G7 nations come together, the world's major industrial countries come together and agree that there can be no new funding for coal. Now, it's got to go farther than that. It's got to be coal. It's got to be natural gas. It's got to be oil, petroleum. We need to stop building new fossil fuel infrastructure now, and we need to dramatically transition off fossil fuels. And I say this as in Congress right now, they've just passed a $1 trillion infrastructure package that really doesn't do very much at all to move the ball down the field. But there is this reconciliation bill that Democrats are likely to have to pass on a partisan basis. And that has a number of measures in it that would potentially allow us to honor the pledge that President Biden has made, that the U.S. will bring its carbon emissions down by a factor of two within the next decade. And that's brought a number of other players to the table. That leadership, that renewed leadership by the United States now is leading to greater engagement by other countries. So there's some reason for cautious optimism that we're starting to head in the right direction, but we've still got a lot of work to do.
And experts are saying that Congress has to pass this reconciliation bill ahead of COP26, which is the next major international climate conference in November, to lock in strong U.S. action, and that would put the pressure on major emitters around the world to finally cut their emissions. Because they're saying, look, if the United States doesn't move, why should we? So, Professor Mann, can you talk about how important this reconciliation bill is?
Yeah, it's critical because, look, the administration, the Biden administration has done everything they can from the executive side to try to meet our obligations to the global community. The administration has pledged to bring carbon emissions down by factor two. And there was this array of executive actions you may remember from earlier this year that really does try to implement climate-friendly policies, federal policies throughout our government. But there's only so much that the president alone can do. We need to codify many of these measures with legislation. And the only way that's going to happen is if we can pass a bill containing meaningful climate action through the Congress. This reconciliation bill contains a number of measures that would provide a very large amount of funding for renewable energy infrastructure, subsidies for renewable energy, that would provide incentives that work against fossil fuel energy. It would introduce what's known as a clean energy standard that would require utilities to purchase an increasingly large share of their power from renewable sources. So that those are the sorts of measures that could allow the United States to actually make good on its pledge to bring carbon emissions down by 50% within the next decade. And to have that in hand, for the Biden administration to say we have legislation now that backs up our commitment that will have a huge influence in Glasgow later this year when we try to get all the other countries of the world to make similarly impressive and bold pledges themselves.
Well, I know we have to let you go, Professor Mann, so thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Linda Mearns will be staying with us for the rest of the hour. Linda is one of the lead law authors of the North America section of the Climate Report. Linda, before we go to break, what would you add on that? I'm just thinking about where we need to go from here and hearing UN Secretary Antonio Guterres saying that this report must sound a death knell for coal and fossil fuels. It made me think about the Guardian report that came out a couple years ago that found Chevron, Exxon, BP, and Shell are behind more than 10% of the world's carbon emissions since 1965. They had a huge report called The 20 Firms Behind a Third of All Carbon Emissions.
Right. Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to bring up the other side of the mitigation. The mitigation is, of course, really extremely important, but I think it's important to recognize that we're also going to have to adapt because we already have climate change going on that we're maladapted to. And so one of the things, for example, in the infrastructure bill, there is language for providing funding for adaptation measures for infrastructure. And that's very important because infrastructure tends to be very long-lived systems. And so you really have to have roads and bridges and other structures that can really resist the climate change that is already happening, but also the climate change that will still occur because we will not be able to get to carbon net zero next year.
Right.
And so I think we really have to do both. Mm-hmm. A lot of emphasis is put on mitigation. That's very appropriate. But we really have to have funding and methods for adapting all systems to the climate change that is here and the climate change that will come along in the next few decades.
This is such an important point. We're going to take a break and we'll continue talking about adaptation after our break. Linda Mearns is one of the lead authors of the North America section of the Climate Report. Linda Mearns is a senior scientist and director of the Weather and Climate Impacts Assessment Science Program at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Today, we are talking about the new Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And we're joined by Linda Mearns, one of the lead authors of the North America section of the report, which you can find at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Dr. Daly Sambo-Durow, chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, an organization that represents 165,000 Inuit across the Alaska, Canada, Russia, and Greenland. Dr. Sambo-Durow is member of the Facilitative Working Group of the Local Communities and Indigenous Peoples Platform of the UNFCC. Hi, Daly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I just wonder, picking up on what Linda just said before the break, that there's kind of two tracks that we need to talk about: where we are today and how so many communities, especially frontline communities, have to adapt, and then where we need to go. And those are the bigger issues around calling for an end to new coal plants and fossil fuel exploration, for example. Can you talk to us about how frontline communities see these two tracks?
Well, first of all, I'd like to share that Indigenous peoples have been warning the world community about these changes for at least a decade now, and not surprisingly, here we are. In terms of adaptation and response, this is an area that we've been dealing with on the front lines, as you say. Our people out there and on the sea ice and out on the land, especially the coastal communities, have been witnessing the changes and have been adapting because they have. One example that I shared recently are the conditions facing marine mammals, including the walrus, that are an important keystone cultural species for our relations on St. Lawrence Island in the middle of the Bering Strait. And so we've been adapting. In fact, our entire history is really a record of adaptation to the cold climate region of the Arctic. And this is the latest phase of adaptation. Mm-hmm. And in terms of going forward, I think one of the key messages I want to bring forward is the need for the world community to recognize and respect what Indigenous peoples have to offer as the firsthand eyes of the change that's taking place throughout our homeland.
You know, Daly, it's important. You just reminded me of a segment I saw with Tara Hauska last week on Democracy Now, talking about Line 3. That is the proposed pipeline expansion to bring 1 million barrels of tar sands per day from Alberta, Canada, to Superior, Wisconsin. And a number of Indigenous activists were hit with tear gas, rubber and pepper bullets. Tara Hauska showed her arms were bloody. And she basically said, I think, what a lot of Indigenous people believe. She says, if it takes seeing Indigenous bodies being brutalized to understand what is really occurring in real time, what is happening to the people as we're defending these last places, then that's what I'm willing to do.
Well, I think that adds a really different dimension to the phrase Code Red. And, you know, that is the present buzzword in terms of climate change and the impacts that we're seeing. And indeed, Indigenous peoples and the threat, the very genuine threat that they face has called to action people to do numerous things at every scale possible, at the local level, the regional level, national level, the international level. And seemingly our voices are not being heard, despite the extreme actions that Indigenous peoples are taking and willing to take. So it really comes down to the place and the space of nation states to work with us to curb the contributions that humans are making to climate change. And I think that's one of the significant messages of this assessment report, is that it is undeniable that human beings are contributing to the dramatic changes that have put us in the place of code red, to repeat that quote. I think it's imperative that not only for the sake of Inuit and other Indigenous peoples across the globe, that action and implementation of the actions that member states and others have committed to needs to take place. And I suppose to a large extent, it really is to implement in a intellectually honest fashion the commitments that member states of the UNFCCC, of the United Nations, have taken in response to climate change. And one large element of that is the fact that the UN General Assembly has also adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples 14 years ago, September 13, 2007. But implementation has been lacking. And one of the provisions of the UN Declaration is not only the fact that Indigenous peoples have the right to a safe and healthy environment, but also our knowledge is central to management of resources. And if we look at all of the messaging, the important science that has been brought together through the assessment report, it is clear that there are huge missing elements, but even more clarity around the lack of implementation of the commitments, the solemn commitments that UN member states have undertaken but not advanced in an urgent way. And I think that's really clearly one of the key messages of this sixth assessment report.
Linda, what would you add to that? And what would you say about the lack of implementation?
Well, first of all, let me address this from the IPCC point of view. And I very much appreciated the doctor's comments on this. I had the privilege of working with Native Americans off the North Slope of Alaska on a project a number of years ago. So I have some familiarity with that. What's to be looked forward to in the Working Group 2 report is there is actually a great deal, much greater attention paid to Native communities in several different ways, both about in terms of the effects of climate change on Native communities, but also recognizing the scientific contributions of Native communities. And that's really a very nice addition. This is mainly in the Working Group 2 report, which will be coming out in February. But I think it's such a good sign that Native communities are really now being brought to the fore in the climate change problem, both in terms of how they would be impacted, how they have already adapted, but also in terms of their scientific their scientific knowledge. How, for example, interviews with older Native members to what degree their memories of the climate of the past agree with or are in contrast to the more traditional Western scientific information. And if there is a contrast, it's not assumed that the Western scientific approach is superior. Real efforts are made to resolve that conflict and understand what that means. So I'm very, very impressed with that further development within the IPCC.
Daly, do you talked about having a seat at the table, and the activism that has happened over the last, you know, decade or more, as you say, I mean, it's now getting more mainstream attention. Indigenous activists are at the forefront of that. When it comes to these kinds of papers, do you feel like Indigenous people do have a seat at the table now?
Well, I think that what Linda has stated, that we're beginning to see some cracks and fissures, I suppose, as far as Indigenous knowledge is concerned. And let me also share the perspective of the Inuit Circumpolar Council on this point, is that we don't regard Indigenous knowledge as science, but rather, in fact, we've developed our own definition of the term Indigenous knowledge based upon our longstanding observations. And I greatly appreciate what Linda Mearns has said about elders and the knowledge, their memory, their profound relationship with the environment. And so I regard it as distinct. But I do believe that we are making advances. But I think more work needs to be done to genuinely ensure the recognition of and respect for Indigenous knowledge holders and what they have to offer through the engagement and use of Indigenous knowledge, and that there are incredible opportunities for the co-production of knowledge so that scientists, as well as, and perhaps even more importantly, policy and decision makers, have the best available knowledge based on science and Indigenous knowledge to drive the decisions that are needed at all scales. So I do think that advances have been made, but we also have to recognize that states and others have not historically taken the views of Indigenous peoples to the center of decision making, and the level of disrespect shown to what we have to contribute remains significant. And there's a real need for us to move away from notions of superiority when it comes to the crisis that we're facing. And so, yes, progress has been made, but there's still a long ways to go. We're fortunate that we have opportunities in terms of the IPCC. Indeed, the Inuit Circumpolar Council is an observer to the IPCC. We're fortunate to gain that status recently. But in other parts of the world, the need for understanding of the legitimacy of Indigenous voices, especially because of the reliance upon their respective ecosystems and environment, which is being impacted dramatically. There's a need to embrace Indigenous peoples across the globe. So in the Arctic and for Inuit, we have made some headway, but there's a long ways to go in terms of recognizing the rights of Indigenous peoples and also the contributions that Indigenous peoples can make to the world community and this particular issue.
Dr. Daly Sambo-Duro is chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, an organization that represents 165,000 Inuit across Alaska, Canada, Russia, and Greenland. Dr. Linda Mearns is one of the lead authors of the North America section of the IPCC report. Linda Mearns is a senior scientist and director of the Weather and Climate Impacts Assessment Science Program at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. If you have any questions or comments about the IPCC report, where we are today, where we're going, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet at your call radio. Steve writes on Twitter, thanks for being relentless in communicating the nature of problems in a solid, matter-of-fact way. Public opinion can be budged and eventually a tipping point can be reached that will create a massive sea change in policy. Well, based on the media coverage, Steve, things are changing. It's just gotten nonstop coverage, which is a nice change. Thank you for the comment. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I guess I haven't read the 3,000-page report, but I have seen enough and listened to enough people on both the radio and TV to know that my feeling is that obviously we're in a crisis right now, and we have been for the last 10 years, if not longer. Even if emissions are cut by 50% by 2030, I think that what people are going to notice is that there's going to be if they think things are bad now, by 2030, even if cut in half, they're going to be significantly worse. And I think this is what people who produced the report are indicating, is that, and I heard one of the scientists who was involved saying, look, at this point, basically all we can do, even if we were able to get towards 50% by 2030, is just slow down, perhaps, the impacts. Because I think by 2030, and the big if is, how are you going to get the 50% reduction by 2030, and I'll make a suggestion. At this point, things are so serious, maybe this is going to be laughable to some of these people listening. I think the scientists who know about this, it's time for them to go to Washington and engage in civil disobedience at the Capitol and just say, look, this is it. We've got to change this policy, because you're not going to see the politicians or the corporations change this unless they are absolutely strangled by the neck to try and get this done. And that's short of that. That's not going to happen. So I don't think, quite frankly, with all due respect to your panel, and Professor Mann, who was on your show several weeks ago, I asked him this question. I said, even if you get to 50% reduction by 2030, that means you're only going to be down to 15 billion metric tons of emissions by 2030. What's that going to mean?
Well, let's ask one of the lead authors of the North America section. Linda, how would you address the first part? If emissions are cut by 50% by 2030, what does that mean?
Well, I think I basically agree with the caller. My perspective is that, yes, we need to very strongly mitigate. I do have some hope by the fact that, for example, the United States is back in is a part of the Paris Agreement. And I think the return of the U.S. and some of the Biden policies are really, really going to help, because this is not a problem that can be solved by the U.S. alone. I also want to say that I agree with the caller that climate activism on the part of climate scientists is also very important. And I think there has been activity by climate scientists in the past in terms of civil disobedience and so forth. And I think you're right. I think this may really be a moment when that really needs to be considered again. Finally, regarding the 50% reduction in emissions, I'm personally, after going through some very grim years for the United States, I'm just so glad that we have climate policies again, and that we can take a leading position. I have some hope that we'll be able to push harder the United States and hopefully other countries to really get down as far as we can. I think, for example, getting down to 1.5 degrees centigrade, personally, I think that's very unlikely at this point. But I think we could hold it at 2 degrees C, and that would still make a big difference. Yes, there would be losses, particularly, for example, for ocean ecosystems. I think the coral reefs would pretty much be gone if we can't hold it at 1.5 degrees C. But 2 degrees C still would give us a livable world, and that's really, really very important.
Oh, it's devastating to hear you say that about the coral reefs.
Yes.
Really devastating. Daly, what would you add to that?
Well, I think that my entire life as an Inuk, as an Indigenous person, when we consider the term mitigate, we've been trying to mitigate for a long time. I mean, the definition is to make less severe, to make less painful. If you look at Indigenous peoples historically, that's what we've been doing our entire lives. But to the point here, I do agree with the caller that the notion of civil disobedience and taking it to the streets, I think it is a political enterprise and potentially will come to this important tipping point. Your reference to Terry Housky and the civil disobedience that we're seeing there, maybe that is the next step. That's for everyone to respond to in whatever fashion they choose, including Indigenous peoples. At the same time, though, I think that the change is relative. The reference to the coral reefs, if we simply go through the policy summary report, the policy summary and the technical summary, and the references to sea ice, which is absolutely crucial to our people who rely upon the marine environment and the potential and the reality of loss of sea ice. And the report is very clear on this point. It will be devastating to our food security, which is interrelated with every other aspect of our lives. And this is highly significant. And so the term code red and the urgency by which this is being underscored in this sixth assessment report for our people and across the Arctic, this is huge. In fact, if you just do a quick search of the term Arctic and the impacts both in the circumpolar Arctic as well as Antarctica, it is there's no other way to put it. Is stunning. And so I think that we're not in any way overstating any of the statements that we're making as an organization or that Indigenous peoples generally are making in terms of their, again, the important relationship that Indigenous peoples have, which is pivotal to all of our communities. So I think the discussion really does have to turn to what are the concrete actions that people are willing to take at every possible level. And the role of third parties and corporations needs to be looked at very carefully, as well as governments. For the Arctic region and now the growing interest, the growing geostrategic and geopolitical interest in our homelands means that we're not only dealing with the eight Arctic nation states, but we're dealing with many other more significant and powerful economic forces like China. And we need to take action collectively And people really do need to address their motivations. We have forces, economic forces, that are constantly scanning the globe for their own energy security, their own food security. What about everyone's food security? What about everyone's energy security in a way that is ultimately sustainable for the whole planet? Issues like the sustainable development goals, in the face of such an urgent issue, what are the real questions? You know, I actually have found it as an Inuk, as an Indigenous person, somewhat laughable that we have these sustainable development goals when, in fact, Indigenous peoples are the sustainable developers in the world, and we're being only categorized as the vulnerable people, when in fact we have much to offer in terms of the response to climate change as well as sustainable development and across the board. Mm-hmm. Sorry to be long-winded about it, but I feel very passionate about the role and the space and the place of Indigenous peoples in all of these global dialogues.
No need to apologize. These are such important points. I wish we had another hour with both of you. Linda, would you leave us with some final thoughts? We've got about a minute left.
I'll give you a feel for what it's like having been in studying climate science for a long time. I used to say that climate change is serious, certain, and soon. But I don't say that anymore. I say it's very serious, it's very certain, and it's now. And I think that's one of the strengths of this report, is that it really demonstrates that we are in it. We are already in the change. And it's a question of how far we're going to just let it go and how much damage we're going to let happen.
Dr. Linda Mearns is one of the lead authors of the North America section of the IPCC report. Linda Mearns is senior scientist at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Daly Sambo-Duro is chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council and member of the Facilitative Working Group of the Local Communities and Indigenous Peoples Platform of the UNFCCC. Thank you both so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.